Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware is Asus's Z97, the ultimate motherboard. Is bargain liquid cooling pointless? The awesome N-Case Anker's 5-port charger versus your rat's nest. AMD's new Opterons are badass, and Crysis 3 running into 8K. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 266, recorded May 8th, 2014. Gold-plated motherboards and shiny green crowbars. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most entertaining, and most delightful news and tech hardware. We love the computers, we love the gaming, we love the tablets, and occasionally we even love the smartphones. You know what I love most of all today? Mr. Ryan Schrout, who is sadly Arkham Asylum crowbar free at the moment. I'm assuming that was an Arkham Asylum crowbar you were brandishing earlier.
No, this is a fluorescent green crowbar sent to me by NVIDIA. Uh-huh. This is odd. And it says on it, "What would Gordon do?"
Hence my Arkham Asylum assumption.
So this is Gordon Freeman from Half-Life. So there's actually, it's hard to see here, but there's a Half-Life 2 logo over here, and then there's an NVIDIA Shield logo over here. So my guess is Half-Life 2 is going to be released on the Shield. That's just a guess.
Interesting. It's a good guess.
And to celebrate this, they felt the need to send out fluorescent green painted steel crowbars.
You know, you never realize how useful a crowbar is until you have one. Demolition.
Yeah.
Pulling nails, breaking and entering, adjusting attitudes on the street.
I feel like I don't want to use it for actual demolition. Like, this should be like hung up on a wall or put on a shelf to be found in 6 years to be put into a yard sale. Something along those lines.
Or you can just sell it on eBay right now at its maximum value and donate the profits to charity. Just saying.
It's not the worst idea you've ever had. It's not the worst idea.
Asus Z97 Deluxe Motherboard Review. More entitlement writing this up for PCPer.com. Z97 LGA 1150. This is, I got to say, I don't say this ever, I don't think. But this is an attractive motherboard.
You like that, do you?
I got to say, I'm looking at gold heat spreaders. Yep. I'm looking at this strange gold silver orb in the corner. I'm looking at what looked like gold accents on the capacitors in the upper left-hand corner. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no weird pseudo-nuclear tactile, you know, I'm freaking tactical stealing parts off of my rock-crawling Jeep covers on this motherboard. And it's attractive.
Would you call it a classy color scheme for a motherboard?
You know, I would call it an iPhone 5S-ish color scheme for a motherboard.
That's probably fairly insightful, actually. Yeah, it does look a lot like that, doesn't it? Never even thought about it.
Whenever I see gold accents, all I can think is pimptastic, which I'm not sure is a phrase I can say on a family-friendly podcast like this. But this is the flagship motherboard in Asus's channel line of Intel Z97 chipset boards, writes Mori. And it's been kind of, we've been laughing about this for a couple weeks on the podcast, separate and together, Ryan and I, about these sort of like endless lineups, you know. Bob's House of Motherboard delivers 797 new SKUs for the 2014 model year. I got to say, this is MSRP $400. I'm guessing it's going to street somewhere around $300 for this.
I would be surprised if it were that low. It would probably be in the $350 to $400 range. This is definitely their like flagship part, right, in terms of feature set, what you get. And, you know, we actually did a live stream with Asus earlier today. I was, as we record this, I was already streaming for about 5 hours and 15 minutes
today.
So, man, I am ready to be in front of the camera.
if you're feeling punchy, it's not us, except it is us.
Exactly. Yeah. So we looked through like basically their whole series of boards, and they had some really interesting things to say. JJ was on, and he mentioned, you know, overclocking capability will be almost the same from the budget boards, the low cost boards like the Z97A up through the high end board, the Z97 Deluxe, and even into the ROG boards and the Tough Series boards and that kind of thing. It was interesting to see that, you know, a lot of the feature set, a lot of the build quality is going to be universal across these, depending on, you know, independent of what dollar amount you're going to place on your purchase. And what really changes as you move up their product stacks are the included features, things like Thunderbolt being included in the box, things like NFC support, things like 802.11ac, you know, different aspects that don't fundamentally change the feature set, but don't fundamentally change the performance capability of the product, but change the experience and the feature set and what you're actually getting out of the product. Because I think both you and I will agree that it has happened over the last decade is before a lot of these changes started taking place, motherboard experiences became pretty monotonous, right? They were all very much the same.
Not necessarily in a bad way. I mean, it's probably a very, if you're a motherboard manufacturer, and because Intel has pulled so much of the motherboard experience inside of the chipset and you have to use Intel's chipset, then suddenly it becomes very frustrating. How do you market your product? How do you differentiate? Okay, we can overclock and Intel doesn't. What else can we do? So I get that. I mean, it's funny because I'm looking at this picture of the back of the motherboard and I'm seeing dual Ethernet, six USB 3.0 ports. Another four ports, which may be additional USB ports, HDMI, Wi-Fi connectors for antennas, a Thunderbolt EX2 card. You know, it's kind of crazy. We start looking at like 10K rated Japanese capacitors. you know, 16 plus two phase digital power system to drive the CPU and DRAM. So obviously, this is obviously very deluxe. There it is, six SATA 3 ports. An M.2 NGFF 10 gigabit per second port, two SATA Express 10 gigabit per second ports, dual Intel gigabit NIC, an Intel 1218V and an Intel 1211 or I211, a Broadcom 802.11.ac Wi-Fi, which pretty much puts it in the same category as almost every 802.11ac box out there in terms of routers, Bluetooth controller, three PCI Express 16 slots, four PCI Express X1 slots, two-digit diagnostic LED display, which my cheap-ass motherboard has, onboard power reset CMOS clear, which I love, and Memo-K buttons, TPU, EPU, EZ, XMP switches, Crystal Sound 2 audio solution, NFC charger and NFC connect module. So near-field communications and near-field, like basically you're going to plug a charger for your phone into this?
Yeah, so the NFC part of it is there's a USB device. It's an external device that like a little box that sits on top of your desk. You connect to it through USB 3. It actually is a USB 3.0 hub. So you connect one USB 3 input. It has two ports on it, which is that's nice as well. But it also acts as an NFC receiver that you can use for things like transferring pictures, watching videos. You can do it to, you know, they have software that allows you to like log into your PC or open up certain applications when you set your phone on it or next to it. It includes an NFC tag. And it's when you think about it, that's not inherently a motherboard feature, right? Like that's not something that is chipset dependent. This is Asus trying to figure out what can we do to differentiate our products. You know, they have the Qi, which I just found out how it was pronounced today. Qi, spelled Q-I, wireless charger. In this as well, it's another USB device that sits on your desk that enables wireless charging through, you know, through that motherboard, through the USB port on that motherboard, right? And it's, again, it's not a motherboard depend like what you would classically think is a motherboard feature or a chipset feature. It's just something that they were like, hey, this is what we can add into this to make this a compelling product, to try to change how people experience the 802.11ac. You know, that's much more popular on motherboards, wireless is, than it used to be. But they've got, I think this is a 2x2 implementation, right? So that's high performance stuff and a lot of, I think, an interesting mix of things. And that's why, you know, when you looked at the price at $399 MSRP, this is what you are, you know, some of the stuff that is building into that. They include the Thunderbolt EX dual add-on card. So you actually get not just one, but two Thunderbolt ports with that. That's included. And what's interesting to me is that all of those accessories that we just mentioned are actually compatible with the entire series of motherboards, but they're included with this option. with this SKU.
Oh, funny.
They're included, right? But you can buy, you know, that Thunderbolt EX2 for like $40 or $50, I guess, and add it into another Z97 motherboard, right? So if you don't need all these features or you don't think you want to use all these features, then you don't have to buy that most expensive board, and you can, you know, emulate those if you decide you want to change your mind. It's an interesting discussion because I feel like this company has a slightly different philosophy on how they approach something like a new motherboard series. And it's interesting to see because in truth, the chipset itself right. doesn't really change much in terms of features or performance this time around. You get, you know, compatibility with SATA Express and M.2 adapters or M.2 storage connections. And you get support for, I think the most important feature is that you get support for the upcoming Haswell refresh and the Haswell, you know, unlocked, what do we call them, Devil's Canyon parts, as well as Broadwell will be supported on this. So that's kind of like what the chipset offers. But, you know, every motherboard based on this chipset will have that. So how do you differentiate from that? Because this is the time of the year now that it's, now the chipset's a kind of officially out. It's a kind of officially out because it wasn't supposed to be launched until the 11th, but you can buy them already. We're going to see, you know, 10 to 20 boards from all of these vendors released over the next 60 days. So now you have to kind of wade through all this information and all these products and figure out which one are worth buying and why and, you know, measure and judge, you know, appropriately.
Man, it's like trying to buy the bundle you want with a card. I want the high-end capacitors and the superior power management, but I don't need a bunch of the other stuff. So basically, though, this is the top of the line, the luxury. It's very Cadillac in the sense of like having every single cup holder on the planet. When I say Cadillac, yep. I guess I mean 60s Cadillac.
And there's tons of software options there. I think that. There's too much to talk about on even this one particular motherboard than we really should spend time on our 1 hour show each week. So I really encourage people to go read the review that Maury wrote because there's tons of detail on the software and hardware side of things. And the videos that we recorded today that specifically look at the ASUS Z97 lineup will be out on Friday or Saturday of this week. So as probably as people are listening to this, they will be up on PCPro.com to kind of watch the videos where it's explained step by step about what the process is and what the variances are between these different products. And I think it will be useful. It will help make sense of 75 motherboards being released all at once on Newegg.
I mean, it's funny. You look at the benchmarks and they're all benchmarking the same. And then it's like, okay, overclocking, some are going to be, man, it's really about the cup holders. And I say that in an affectionate way because, you know, I kind of like the idea of having Thunderbolt cup holders. not to sound weirder than usual. In something unusual for the podcast, normally we feature liquid coolers from another brand that seems to release liquid coolers every 2 to 3 weeks. Welcome to the Cooler Master Sidon 120-volt liquid CPU cooler review. Sebastian Peake wrote this up for PC Per. Cooler Master's newest 121-millimeter all-in-one liquid CPU cooler and its affordable price adds another option to anyone looking for an aftermarket cooler on a budget. But when we start comparing low-cost options, it's valid to wonder just how much better a liquid cooler in this price range might perform over air. So Sebastian tested the Sidon 120B against a popular budget air solution and then against the stock solutions from A&D and Intel. And that may be more solutions than I've actually said out loud the word in quite some time. This is a really good roundup, in part because kind of the biggest change you can make on a CPU is going from the stock factory Intel or AMD cooler to an aftermarket cooler, air or water. And it's interesting to look at the results. Was this a particularly loud cooler given the expense, or was it a particularly quiet cooler?
I don't think it was particularly one way or the other. The product itself, the Sidon 120V, was kind of a fairly ho-hum product. To be honest, because if you look at that Hyper 212 Evo that he's comparing it to, that's an air cooler. And what's interesting is that's a $35 air cooler.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. Because one of the things, we talked about this a couple months ago, where somebody had compared, you know, a $100 liquid cooling system to like a $45 fan. And it's getting hard. Even the inexpensive air coolers are really good these days.
Yep. And this, the weird thing about this Hyper 212 is it's been around forever. This is an old cooler that is incredibly popular with like budget builders, right? And
it's surprising
to us. I mean, it's like $35 and you get pretty damn good performance. Now, there are plenty of water coolers that will do better than the Side 120V in the long run. But, you know, it's not a losing situation for Cooler Master because they happen to make both of those products, which is okay for them, I guess.
So good thought, though, if you want to look at the conversation between budget air and liquid cooling and is aftermarket cooling necessary. I prefer to use aftermarket cooling on all my builds.
Oh, yeah.
Simply because I cannot stand the cheap-ass fans that come with most CPUs from the factory.
Usually sound awful.
The N-Case M1 Mini ITX crowdfunded case is here. Sebastian got hands-on with this one. This one, we talked about this earlier this year. Actually, was it early last year? Has it been that long since this was crowdfunded?
I think so, yeah.
Wow. So small form factor computing. Oh, my goodness. So actually only about 8 months, right? So the Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign ended in August of last year. Leanne Lee was contracted to make the case. Mm-hmm. And it is small. Take a look at the picture of the M1 next to the BitPhoenix Prodigy, which is not a big case by any stretch of the imagination. And I like that that is a really good looking case. 250 millimeters by 160 millimeters by 338 millimeters, 105 millimeters space for the CPU cooler, three expansion slots, two 3.5-inch, two 2.5-inch hard disk drive mounts. The M1 arrived in a rather dramatic package. I like that note. and can I get back to the fact that I just remembered how much I love this case when we saw the Indiegogo campaign. It's just a case. There's no window. There's no crap. There's holes on the top for the air to go out. You can fit a power supply and a motherboard inside of it. You know, 9.85 inches tall, 6.3 inches wide. Yeah.
And if you look at that thing, it looks unassuming, but you can fit a lot of stuff in there. I like, there's a picture, I think, on the last page. That cut along the top of the case is actually for a slot-loading optical drive bay. And then,
awesome.
Just something about an optical disc. I don't even use them anymore, but the idea of an optical disc like coming out the top of the case like that, where it's barely wider than the optical disc itself, is really, really cool looking. But you can fit a ton of stuff in here, the water cooling and fairly lengthy graphics cards and how it comes apart is really compelling, and how a power supply even fits in this thing is pretty compelling. Like, you can put a regular power supply in there, or you can use one of the Silverstone SFX parts. But I mean, you can fit several hard drives and SSDs. The best way to think about this is this was created by a 500-page thread on HardOCP's forums, right? The person who came up with this was like, hey, what can we do to make a better thing? And he wasn't even the guy that worked for a case manufacturer. He was just a guy. And they, you know, find somebody that could actually do the renderings and do the drawings correctly. And it took a long time, for sure. And it was fairly expensive. I think you had to pay $200 for one of these. So that's pretty steep for a case. But I think they're getting ready to start a second run too. Yeah, there's that picture. I don't even like optical drives anymore. I wish they would go away. But that picture is really cool.
If the optical drive goes away, I can't play Blu-ray players. So, you know, I might argue a little bit with you there, but it's like, it's a good, clean layout, right? You've got the ability to pull air across. Now, there's, you know, you can only fit an 80 or 92 millimeter fan in the back, but you've got plenty of room for 120 millimeter fans at the top and bottom of the case. I like it. It's gorgeous.
I think the website is... where's it at? I thought they had a thing because they're doing They're doing it. They're getting ready to start a second run.
Available soon. Get notified, says the webpage.
Okay. Yeah. So, like, the first ones in the Indiegogo, you had to, I think it was, I don't remember what it was now, but I want to say it was like $200.
Right.
To do that, but that.
Sometimes you pay to get what you want in this world.
Yeah, it's incases.com. N-C-A-S-E-S. And world, they call it the world's smallest 240-millimeter radiator-capable mini ITX chassis, which is maybe a lot of qualifiers. But, you know, you do what you can do. Good for them.
Yeah, that's awesome. I am going to undermine Ryan's report about the Anker 40-watt 5-port wall charger and second-gen Astro 3 12,000 milliamp hour battery review, because I have the second-gen Astro 3 12,000 milliamp hour battery review along with a 6,000 milliamp hour battery from Astro. And I'm going to say I don't have the 5-port wall charger, but I've been needing to buy one for several weeks on Amazon to replace the mess of chargers inside the charging station in my house. But I will say the second-gen Astro 3 is a badass portable battery or portable charger for your phone or tablet. Do you disagree with me, sir?
No, I don't. You know, what's interesting is they sent me this set of accessories, and I thought I would like the battery more, and the wall charger is just a wall charger. So I thought, who cares, right?
No, wall charger is badass, dude.
It's a 40-watt wall charger. It's a 40-watt 5-port USB wall charger. And I had the previous generation Anker unit, which was 25 watts. Mm-hmm. And each port had like a different amperage that it would output at, right. And it had like a really tiny label on it. Both the wall charger and the battery have smart ports. Which, right. You know, auto communicates with the device and says, hey, you know, how much power do you want? I'll send you as much as I can get up to that amount.
Anker's Power IQ technology, yes. Which basically means it gives the device what it wants to pull, which is what your power supply is supposed to do. But
yeah.
Let me translate. Like 40 watts, basically that means four of those ports can be charging 2-amp tablets simultaneously without a problem. If, like me, you have a, you know, like sort of a charging station that's a box with power supplies inside of it, that's the equivalent of four, you know, Apple iPad or, you know, Galaxy tablet chargers stuffed inside of that box. And notice, you know, it may look big because it is big in that picture, but it is relatively small. And it will, you know, it's if you have like a couple tablets, a couple smartphones, you know, a Bluetooth headset, a couple other gadgets, all of a sudden your life is a hot mess of chargers. And this thing, you know, I'm ordering it tonight. I've been waiting too long.
I mean, the 5-port 40-watt wall charger, it's $25.
Yeah.
Right? And it made like we have two of them in the office now, and we have like one on a shelf back here that has kind of like all of our tablets and things that we may need to use for testing soon. And then one is up front where, you know, I'll come in and I'll plug in my phone. Ken can plug in his phone. I can plug in my iPad, and you don't have to worry about having a power strip with five different, you know, wall warts on it to do that. And it's convenient. Like if you go out of town and you have, like I usually would have like one or two phones and a tablet, and you don't have to bring three different chargers. You have to make sure you bring the cables for it. And you can be the nice guy at the airport and let other people charge their phones or whatever it happens to be. So that to me is like an easy sell for $25.
Yeah.
The 40 watt charger. The battery is maybe a little bit tougher sell. It's a little more expensive. But what do you think about yours that you have so far?
Okay, so Anker has three of the Astro 3 batteries. They are, you know, it's funny. We've seen a bunch of really nice batteries. The first one I saw is what I'm going to think of as like next generation external batteries, right? One of the first ones we saw is from an automotive gauge company called PLX, and they showed it off at SEMA. And then we saw Anker at CES, and they were giving away the Astro 3 6,000 milliamp hour external battery charger. So the 6,000 milliamp battery charger, I want to say starts at $25 or $30. And of course, I opened up the Anchor webpage and not the Amazon webpage. But they basically have three versions: the 6,000 milliamp hour with one port, the 9,000 milliamp hour, and then the 12,000 milliamp hour, which has three ports. And then I want to say they have like another half dozen chargers out there that are older models and newer models. But the build quality is really surprising. So that's the wall charger we were talking about that'll do up to 8 amps of charging simultaneously. You can split that charging across all the ports. And then the battery chargers range from about, 2.5 to 4.5 fingers of width. And these Patrick fingers are kind of big. But, you're looking at like 4.5 stars across 1,000 ratings on Amazon, which is shockingly good. So there's the three ports. It's the Power IQ technology, which basically will give you up to 2 amps. You can split 4 amps across the three ports. They have their sort of shake technology. All of the communications is via this ring of LEDs on the side. When it's charging, from a wall through a mini USB cable, you're going to have to supply your own power supply to charge it. It basically does the looping thing. When you shake it, there you can see there, it was on for a second. It tells you what percentage of your charge is left. It's not like, 97%, but there's 10 right. of those little LED segments in that circle. So you're looking at roughly 10% drops in it. I've carried like my first really serious... I carried an Energizer like XP 18,000 battery charger. Fine, I just hit a Texilla Bytes about this, which weighs like 2.5 pounds, and it has a power brick the size of most laptop power bricks, right? I carried that for 2.5 years in my bag, in part because I was carrying wireless modems that need a 2-amp charger and then would have 90 minutes of battery life. So if I needed to do a bunch of work while I traveled, I would be SOL, to use a highly technical term. The Anchor, the second gen Astro 3, that 12,000 milliamp hour battery is less than 1/3 the cost, has 2/3 of the power, and weighs less than, well under half of what that big old Energizer battery does. Now, the Energizer battery does like 19 volts and 12 volts along with 5 volts, but for 90% of what I do, a USB charger will take care of it. Did you find yourself using this that much? Because when I commute on the bus or the ferry, I am kind of like, I immediately plug the modem, into the power supply. If my phone's low, I'm charging it up and carrying it around. I've used them constantly.
I honestly haven't used it in other than testing it and kind of using it, draining it all the way through and charging it and kind of seeing how all that worked. I haven't actually used it in a day-to-day experience, right? Because I don't commute very far, and I haven't gone on a trip since I got this in, really. Mm-hmm. I would say I will take this with me on my next trip. It will be the charger. It will be the battery that's in my backpack, right? And then whenever I have a phone battery issue or a tablet battery issue, mm-hmm. that'll be the go-to part for it. Because this one's only capable. This one's capable of up to 4 amps through 3 ports. You can charge, 2 full iPads with it. Well, let me rephrase that. You can charge 2 iPads at full rate. But the battery capacity is not big enough to charge 2 full iPads. I think an iPad Air is like an 8,000 milliamp hour battery.
Exactly. So this is like
1.5 iPad Airs.
Yeah, about 1.5 iPad Airs. You're looking at for the 6, even the 6,000 is roughly 4 iPhones or 2.5 Galaxy S5s in terms of the milliamp hours. One of the tricks when you're using a portable charger like this is you charge your phone or your tablet up to 80% and then stop. And when it gets back down to 20%, charge it back up to 80% again. Because the way battery cycling works is that last sort of 10 or 20% of the charge tends to consume a lot of the charging power that goes into a battery, which is not the most graceful or technically sophisticated way of displaying it. But a couple different portable battery manufacturers are like, just charge your phone up to 80% like 3 times instead of charging it to 100% 2 times. And it's like the math is weird, but in casual use, it works out pretty well. I was surprised at, it's funny because a lot of the portable chargers they felt cheap. They took up a lot of space. They look like they're about to fall apart. The Anchors feel, these second gen Astros, they feel nice in the hand. The display is simple. I had one fail on me tech support got me a new one almost immediately, and it was extremely unusual. I mean, you know, for the 6,000 amp hour Anker second gen Astro, there's like 1,100 customer reviews, and it's at 4.5 stars.
Yeah.
That is unusual for Amazon. Products that fall apart do not get ratings that high on Amazon, because people who buy things on Amazon and don't like the way they work get really pissed. They go
back. Oh, yeah. They go back and write about it. Yeah.
If they don't like the packaging, if they don't like the description, they sort of tee off on it. But, you know, that's they've been good to deal with, and I like the part. You know, I like the parts, and I've been using them pretty constantly. So it'll be interesting to see how the battery holds up over time.
Agreed.
So I'm excited, dude. I got to finish getting that 5-port wall charger. So you should talk about the next story while I try to find my credit card.
All right, can't do. Intel and Google hosted an event this week, a Chrome OS event, to announce new products based on Haswell i3 and Bay Trail SoCs. We saw parts from Lenovo. We saw parts from Asus, Acer, HP, Toshiba. They were all announcing new parts based using Chrome OS based on these new parts. And these are, I mean, nothing super magic about what the hardware we're talking about here is. Lower end Haswell i3s, the same Bay Trail parts that we have seen in some of the higher end tablets like the Asus T100. And basically they were updating Chromebooks to utilize both of these technologies. And they kind of are like Chromebooks that you would expect to see, right? 11.6 inch or 13.3 inch. They all had 1366 by 766 or 1366 by 768 resolution screens. Prices from $249 to $349, depending on the size. Then they had Chrome boxes, which are kind of like the Nooks, but using Chrome OS. Asus has one of those. HP has one of those. And they also introduced something called a Chrome Base, which I'm not a huge fan of the term, but it is essentially a Chrome OS all-in-one,
right?
Like all-in-one PC using Chrome OS.
LG is going to be dropping a pretty good-looking Chrome Base, which is just awkward to say.
I
just realized it's funny because the sales on these continue to climb. I'm like, we're going to have to review some of these on Techzilla. Just as you know, it's something we've been asking the audience if they're interested in, and they seem to be selling a lot of these, not like tablet numbers, but certainly more than I would have expected.
Yep, like the Asus Chromebook C200 and C300, they use the Bay Trail M dual core processor, 2.4 gigahertz, 11.6 and 13.3, 2 gigs of memory, 16 gigs of storage, 802 Dell 11 AC2 dual band. USB 2, USB 3, HDMI, 2.5 pounds for the smaller one, 3.1 pounds for the bigger one. Overall, pretty interesting devices. I think Lenovo also announced their specific models. But again, very similar sizes, very similar prices, very similar specifications. I think Lenovo one, the N20P, will do like a 300-degree rotation, kind of like almost yoga, but not quite yoga. but again, you're talking about $250 to $350 products. So it's easy to see the interest in these devices for a lot of people who only concern themselves with web browsing as their, you know, content consumption medium.
Well, people who use the cloud for their life. I mean, because I'm also, you know, the rumor is that these are going to start showing up in, you know, more and more in corporate settings where they want to lock down the functionality that the users have inside of the organization. I don't know how much of that I buy into because so much of life in so many large corporations seems to still run on Windows applications that go back to the 16-bit days. but it'll be interesting to see. You know, and I'm kind of curious to get hands-on because some decent manufacturers are making these, and I'm kind of curious to see what kind of fit and finish they can get out of a $250 box with a screen, especially if you're talking about like a 21.5-inch screen on a desktop. So I wait with bated breath. What's the story with Skylake and the 100 series chipsets?
Not a lot here, just roadmap. I thought it was mostly interesting, a little bit of a tease of what the 2015 platforms are going to be like for Intel processor platforms. Skylake. I did the same thing. Skylake is the name of that. Although I find the most interesting part that it's going to be the 100 series for chipsets. So like Z100, like Z109 maybe, something like that. I don't really know where they're going with it. But Thunderbolt, it's a season increase from Falcon Ridge and Redwood to Alpine Ridge. We're talking about slightly better LAN controllers, LTE modems being embedded in the wireless controllers, which could be if low cost enough, and if any carrier in the U.S. would like make it interesting, could be really, really, really compelling for if almost all notebooks started shipping with LTE embedded in them instead of like just the high kind of high priced over or not overpriced, but expensive business models. If we could get plans that are reasonable for always on connectivity on laptops without having to have Wi-Fi around, that would be pretty awesome. But otherwise, not a whole lot about the processors other than we're looking at quad core parts still. Nothing magical standing out about any 6-core or 8-core mainstream processors, which is maybe a little bit disappointing for some people.
Yeah, it's funny. We had a question. We had a question on Twitter, and I was laughing about this one because it's Where did it go? Michael tweeted, I have an i7-2600K. What's coming this summer that I should upgrade to for CPU, and what socket will it be? And, you know, it is anything look like it's going to be that much faster with the Z100 chipset? I'm assuming it's going to be a Z100. Man, it's at the high end, it's getting tougher and tougher. At least to me, it feels like it's getting tougher and tougher to justify a new CPU unless you're in some sort of multi-threaded application and you're going, 8, 16, how many virtual machines can I run simultaneously? But for the majority of users, it seems like I want to spend more money on GPU than CPU at this point.
Yeah, I agree. Still the case.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the sound of a man that has been thinking way too much about motherboards for the last 6 hours today.
Very true.
Yes. Next. Yes. AMD shows off ARM-based Opteron A1100 server processor and reference motherboard, which means AMD is continuing to figure out a place for itself in the universe moving forward outside of low-end gaming PCs, general-purpose PCs, and the less expensive laptop market. AMD showed off its first ARM-based Seattle processor running on a reference platform motherboard at an event in San Francisco earlier this week. The new chip, which began sampling in March, is slated for general availability in Q4 2014, writes Tim Berry. The Seattle processor will officially labeled the AMD Opteron A1100. So they're running a reference design, LAMP software stack, including an ARM-optimized version of Linux based on an RHEL, Apache 2.4.6, MySQL 5.5.35, and PHP 5.4.16. Hint, they expect this to be used in gigantic data centers because the server was used to host a WordPress blog that included streamable video, 8 ARM Cortex A57 cores clocked in at 2 gigahertz or higher, integrated memory controller, trust zone encryption hardware, floating point neon video acceleration hardware. Quote, like a true system on a chip, the Opteron A1100 supports 8 lanes of PCI Express 3.0, 8 SATA, 3 6 gigabit per second ports, and 2 10 gigabit per second Ethernet network connections. So 2 and 4 times performance. AMD is basically claiming that the A1100 is going to deliver 2 and 4 times performance of the existing Opteron X series, which uses 4 x86 Jaguar cores clocked in at 1.9 gigahertz. And it's a 25-watt TDP manufactured by Global Foundries. That's crazy, dude. Like 3 more watts, 2 and 4 times the performance.
It's so odd. The Opteron A1100 features 8 ARM Cortex A57. I'm like, what in the hell is going on? What did they just say? And they also announced at this event, we'll probably talk about this later. I know Josh is writing up an editorial on it that looks at, so this is using off-the-shelf kind of Cortex A57 parts. AMD announced that they're building what they're calling the K12, which is custom-built ARM cores, right? Not, you know, like Qualcomm does now, custom ARM architecture parts, not just stuff that ARM designs themselves. So it's getting real weird for me. Like, I don't know. I kind of wish they hadn't used the K12 name for that, because I would K12, in my mind, should be the next x86 core. They did announce they're doing a new x86 core as well. So I'm really curious to see over the next 2 to 3 years how AMD as a company balances, we're designing a new x86 core from scratch and we're designing a new ARM core from scratch, and how those two meet, how they don't meet, and how, you know, what targets they're at. Is the x86 core going to be a high performance part? Is the ARM core going to be the high performance part, and we're going to be, you know, the same performance level mainstream style APUs for the x86 side? I don't know. I think it's gonna be interesting. But the announcements they kind of made at that show were kind of like bombshell almost of what they did, because we didn't expect much going in to what they were going to say.
I know that kind of, no, I mean, and that kind of performance for the power they're talking about, that could give them a serious future in populating the giant warehouse sized data centers that everybody seems to be building every 15 minutes near whatever, you know, hydro source of electricity they can find.
Yep.
So it's interesting. MSI ships the GS70 Stealth Pro and the GS60 Ghost Pro 3K gaming notebooks. Is 3K as in sort of like, you know, WQHL, not quite 4K gaming, or is that 3K as in the series?
No, the 3K is the resolution.
Okay.
That is 2880 by 1620. Yeah, 2880 by 1620 is what they are calling 3K. What's interesting?
WQHD Plus, which I've never heard referred to anywhere else before.
That's brand new to me.
Jeez. There was a sale on 15.6-inch glass.
Right, that's a weird part to me. They announced the Stealth Pro and the Ghost Pro 3K. And the Stealth Pro is a 17-inch 1080p screen using a GTX 870. And then the Ghost Pro 3K is 15.6-inch 2880 by 1620 GTX 870M. So they use the same GPU but less memory with the 15-inch higher resolution screen than they do with the 17-inch, just standard, you know, HD 1080p screen. Not 100% sure
about what we live in.
It really is. I guess they just don't expect anybody to game at that resolution.
Right.
Like, you game at 1080p, and then you get better picture quality due to the screen scaling. Right.
Maybe, I guess.
I don't get it. They clearly you cannot game at 2880 by 1620 with the GTX 870 yet. You clearly
Someone
cannot.
Will try and fail and post a really negative review on Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and you know, on a 15-inch monitor, that they're not going to leave the resolution of 2880 by 1620. They're going to turn on scaling at 150 or 200%, right? Because a 15-inch monitor with that resolution at 1-to-1 pixel would be ridiculous. Yeah. Right. I mean, even the 28-inch monitor, 28-inch 4K that we were testing this week, you know, I am hesitant that I don't think you should really use that at 100% scaling, even with Windows 8 or 8.1. Right.
Wow.
The pixels are just like, if you have to read things a lot, they're just a little too small. Right. So you should probably turn up scaling to 150. Then you get sharp text. But, you lose the bonus real estate, I guess, that you would expect to get, right? So 4K at 40 inches maybe makes a little bit more sense as a desktop monitor if we ever get something like that. So
it would be nice. Yeah. From the strange but true and possibly peculiar department, Crysis 3 hacked to run at 8K, but can anything power it? Sebastian wrote this up for PC Per. We've seen what happens when you put two monstrous graphics cards together with Ryan's look at R9 295 X2 Crossfire setup. And now here's something that would challenge even that. Crysis 3 at 8K resolution. An enthusiast called K-Putt has created a hack to allow the 8K setting, and his Flickr gallery has full-res versions of the screenshots. Be warned, they're huge files. While this likely isn't practical, even with a quad-fire setup like we have for those tests, K-Putt was only getting two
frames per second with a single card setup, it is still very nice to look at.
8,000 by 4,000. 7,200 by 3,000.
Yeah.
These are resolutions. But if you look at these pictures, they're impressive, right? Like, yeah, if you are. Just, even the one that's on our site that's really tall, that looks like it's looking at a dam, and you click for the full size version of that and you kind of like scroll down it, that's really impressive. I know he was only running it at 2 frames per second.
They were pretty frames.
But they were very, very pretty frames per second. It's gorgeous. And I guess I didn't see how he did this, because you obviously don't have an 8K display, I don't think. I don't think he did. Or it's possible you could do, if you had 4 4K monitors, you could set them up in a tile configuration, or 3 4K monitors, you could do that. Well, let's see. He says he had to use a hacked executable. So I don't know what that means exactly. Either way, he got it to run at 4K and or 8K rather, and that's crazy.
It is crazy. It's interesting. If you scroll down to the bottom of that article, you see the Dell 28-inch Ultra HD 4K monitor that's running at 3840 by 2160. The Samsung 20-inch Ultra High Definition LED monitor that Ryan has in for testing, and Seiki's super cheap SE39UY04 39-inch 4K Ultra HD 120Hz LED HD TV. I guess they're just calling it TV now. It's interesting. The reviews on those are all sort of clustered around 3 to 3.5 stars. I think people are getting a little frustrated with trying to game on those monitors. 3840 by 2160 on the Seiki, which is not quite 4K.
it is one 3840 by 2160 is one of the 4K right. Standards, and then the other one's like 4096.
You're only a couple hundred pixels short, but maybe they're the important pixels.
I found on an Extreme Tech story what they did. To get Crysis 3 up to 8K, this user had to use a program called On the Fly that produces a hacked version of the main executable file. This new EXE enables lots of new functionality through the in-game console, allowing him to pump the resolution up, change draw distance, and make other changes on the fly. He also used SweetFX, a program that allows you to customize the game engine's shader code to tweak the output colors and contrast. The end result still looks a lot like Crysis 3, just a little more contrasty. And he was actually running at an ultra-wide 8,000 by 3333 or portrait 3750 by 5,000. And I like that. At 8,000 by 3333, each frame consists of 26.6 million pixels.
Right.
Keep in mind that 1080p is 2 million pixels. So 13 times the resolution of 1080p.
That's a lot of pixels, people. It's also interesting. I just dug a little bit. That's that $499 Seiki, you know, 39-inch 4K monitor is only running 4K at 30 hertz because it's HDMI 1.4 and there's no display port.
Yeah, that's actually the TV. I'm looking at the TV right now. That is what you are being displayed to me on is the 39-inch Seiki TV. You're only running at 30 hertz, so I had to report.
I'm just feeling so stuttery right now. What's going on with the? I mean, are we talking about a free Unreal tournament or a new Unreal tournament? What's the story here?
It is both. It is both new and free.
Wow.
They announced an Unreal tournament is coming back. That it is utterly free with no DLC or pay to win. It will be built on Unreal Engine 4, the one you can license for $19 a month, and will be designed from the ground up to be moddable, and eventually there will be a marketplace where modders can trade, sell, or give away their work. No hint of a release date yet, but the news is so exciting, it almost makes you forget that Unreal Tournament 3 ever existed.
Wow.
This is interesting because we just played on Saturday, we had a virtual LAN party with our forum group, and we played a ton of UT 2004. And it's
everybody loves UT 2004.
It was a blast. I actually had it running at 4K on that monitor, ironically enough. But it's still a fun game to play. And the fact that they are going to kind of do that again, but in the Unreal 4 graphics setup, is pretty awesome.
Good.
We don't know anything else other than that, really. But it's going to be free and it'll be available soon. And it's not soon enough. Well, let me put it this way. It won't be available soon because I think they're just kind of starting.
Soon. So soon. there's an email question that I want to answer because it made me laugh pretty hard. Edvardus. Well, actually, you know, first I should remind you, ladies and gentlemen, twitch@twit.tv is the email address if you want to email the crew here, the sophisticated, talented crew. That would be Ryan and the other guy. That would be me here at twitch@twit.tv. And you can also, yes, you are the talented one. Attractive, too. And quite the basketball enthusiast. PCPer.com is the website that Ryan hangs out at. I'm at techzilla.com. And you can tweet at Ryan Schroud or at Patrick Norton to talk to us directly. It was funny. We were talking about some of the routers that have come out, most notably Linksys' new take on a classic that we saw at CES, and I'm finishing writing up for TechZilla. And Edvardus says, in the question about an actively cooled router, you said that you have never seen a router with active cooling. There are a lot of routers with active cooling, like reasonably priced Cisco 1941W, which has wireless 2 gigabit WAN ports and possibility to add gigabit switch ports. But I have a strange suspicion because you said 802.11ac would be nice gear like Cisco would be overkill, but fun to tinker about. Now, I should point out the Cisco 1941W, if memory serves, is a $1,500 to $1,800 router. So that might be reasonably priced if you are a networking professional or a sysadmin in a large environment. But yes, I was talking about more consumer routers, where $250 is considered to be a lot of money for a router.
Yes.
But Edvardus, I would like to acknowledge that you are absolutely correct, sir, and that there are lots of actively cooled, i.e. fan routers with fans inside of them, if you are spending the long green on the commercial products. And the 1941W is currently selling for $1,416.54. There are three left in stock, and you can get those through Amazon.com. It's a steal. It's a beautiful router. at Ryan Schroud, at Patrick Norton. It's got a big fan. It's got antennas. You know, antennas. It's got to be good. We got a tweet, and of course, because the internet likes to mock me. I missed Logan's at Logan tweets at Ryan Schroud at Patrick Norton. How fast can we expect SSDs to run on SATA E? What will the new bottleneck be?
SATA E. ESATA?
SATA E. I'm assuming it's ESATA, but it was typed out. I cut and pasted this and it was SATA E in the tweet.
Nope, there is. SATA Express. Okay, I've never seen it written as SATA lowercase e. Okay, yeah. I see. Google has saved me again. How fast can we expect SSDs to run on SATA Express? I mean, up to about 10 gigabits per second or so. Is that right? Yeah, I'm getting the nod. So I mean, that's if you do the math and divide by 8, you're looking at like 1.2 gigabytes per second. You got to get in the room some overhead for that. Right. You're probably looking at like the 800 to 900 megabyte per second range, kind of as a peak. But again, you got to look at the controller on the actual SSD itself. Will it be able to do that? And then, you know, once you get up that high, what is that useful for? Does it lower latency? Does it increase latency? I think it will probably not affect it drastically either way.
Right.
But you'll get faster than SATA, for sure.
That's yeah, well, if you have a bunch of SATA drives in a RAID configuration because you have the money and you're kind of crazy, and I love you for that, you know, and you're moving giant-ass files, then you might notice a difference. I think for the vast majority of SATA use scenarios, unless you are working with huge files, you are probably not going to notice much of a real-world difference on that one.
Yep. And I'll be curious to see kind of what the industry creates in terms of SATA Express product. right? many of the Z97 motherboards that are coming out will have support for SATA Express. But I have never physically held a SATA Express device in my hand.
Supposedly, so, Asus is working on one as we speak.
They are. Yes, they are. But still, it doesn't solve my problem. I do not have one. And, you know, I don't want it to be like Thunderbolt, right? Where, hey, this is great, but nobody uses it.
I use Thunderbolt.
I use it too, but we're not everybody. Sometimes
we're not normal.
I mean, when we had this conversation, it's just like you and me. We're the only ones here. But I believe there are other people because I'm not spending enough to keep all the other companies in business. I know that. So there must be other
Wouldn't
people
it be
involved
nice
someplace.
If you were.
Yeah.
We got an email from Andrew. He says, in one of the shows, Patrick and Ryan discussed external battery packs and a solar charger that could be carried in a backpack. Unfortunately, I can't seem to find the show in question. Would appreciate your matter. Love the screensavers. Thank you, Andrew. Most portable solar devices designed to, you know, be adventure, manly, camping, end of the world, need to charge. I mean, and I'm the last one to make fun of sort of prepping and end of the world because, you know, my mom lives in an island that floods a lot. My aunt's been burned out of two homes. I have friends in Southern California that have looked out their back window and seen 70-foot flames on the horizon and had to, like, pack everything they loved into a truck and haul ass towards the other horizon. I live in earthquake country. You know, my wife basically watched half of her neighborhood sort of fall to the ground in the 89. Well, not her neighborhood, but the neighborhood just down the street from her house sort of collapse in the 89 Loma Linda earthquake. So, you know, one of the reasons I have an external, you know, battery pack power charger in my backpack is because, you know, it's not just because I want to use my laptop on the bus or the freaking ferry, but it's because I've been in situations where, having an extra 12, 15, 18 hours of talk time on a phone is a big deal and seriously useful. The Wirecutter is a really good website. And I'm a big fan of it. The article you want to look for is the best solar battery pack. And it's funny. This is the Solar Juice. I know people who own them. Orange makes it. It is one of the rare portable battery packs that a lot of people actually like after they own it. I am not a big fan of the Goal Zero products because they seem to – I know people – and I will admit the people I know are very hard on gear and they have their survivability with the Goal Zero has not been as good as they want. The Solar Juice Orange is not inexpensive. It's about $150. I would definitely recommend reading the write-up on thewirecutter.com. Alexander George wrote that up. It is one of the rare ones where a lot of people like it. Probably the first two or three or four solar charging gadgets for cell phones and stuff I just found atrocious, in part because I live in San Francisco or used to live in San Francisco where there is no sun. So I would have to go somewhere where there was sun. And I found them just as atrocious in places with sun. The Solar Juice, though, Solar Juice does seem to do a really good job. And if you have serious power needs, you probably need to go something much larger than that. But that's a discussion for another show. So should we call it? Should we get you off camera before you snap since you've done like six hours of television already today?
Probably.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ryan Shrout, who is going to be giving us a review in the near future of that Samsung 28-inch ultra-high-definition LED monitor, which supports 60 hertz via DisplayPort. Am I correct about that?
You are correct. Let me give a quick opinion. It's good, but not great, right?
So, you know, it's $700, not $3,400.
Exactly.
There you have it.
both, and as you might guess, the conclusion will kind of merge those two statements, right? So,
with more detailed specs and benchmarking. At this point, is there a single GPU you would use to power this for gaming successfully, or would you pine for dual GPUs on any?
You would have
monitor?
To have at the very least a single 780 Ti or R9 290 290X, and even then, some games are going to be a struggle. You know, like if Battlefield 4, you could probably get away with a single 780 Ti. But it would be tough. And if you know, as we get into other games like Watch Dogs is coming out, that's going to be very graphics intensive. And if you don't want to start turning things down quality wise, you're going to need more GPUs for sure.
So, in terms of a 28-inch monitor, that would also, to me, on some level, seem far too small to justify 4K gaming. Or did you feel it, you benefited from upping the resolution from 1080p to 4K?
I think, yes, definitely. And that's another thing I was going to say. Like, you know, 4K on this still looks great. When you're doing 4K gaming, it looks amazing. But if you're running it at a choppy frame rate, it doesn't feel amazing. But what you can do with this monitor that you could not do with like the PQ321 or the Sharp KN321 4K panel is you can run your games at 1080p or you can run your games at 25x14 if you don't have enough GPU horsepower today. Okay. Right? And it'll still look pretty good. And then, you know, you will still be able to use like the desktop at 4K, or you'll be able to upgrade your graphics hardware and play at 4K later. Right. With the other ones, it was very complicated because it had two scalers. You couldn't do 4K or you couldn't do non-4K resolutions easily.
Right.
Kind of works sometimes, but not really well. This one doesn't have any of that issue. So that's a positive.
The multiple channel or multiple lane configuration on the 4K monitors can be kind of a head-pounding experience.
Yeah, and luckily we're getting away from that, right? So the scalers obviously exist. Hopefully we never have to use the multi-tile, the dual tiles. For that again, maybe when we go up to 8K, we'll have two 4K scalers. But now we just, you know, now we're like, okay, let's see what the panel is like. Now that's the focus. What is the panel like? So, because we've solved one of the problems.
Ladies and gentlemen, on that bright and cheerful note, problems being solved. Ryan Shrout getting off camera before he loses it after the cavalcade of motherboards you saw earlier today. PCPro.com is a website to find the man. You can find me at techzilla.com or die trying. We've been building Raspberry Pi devices and electroshock devices that essentially turn your face into a musical organ.
Is that good?
I'm yet to be decided, but I can guarantee you that I was much more enthusiastic about the sort of headlight upgrades we did to my truck the week after the face organ.
Understandable.
Because, you know, electricity pumped through your skin not only causes your muscles to contract, but it hurts. So
we'll do that.
Hopefully your hardware doesn't hurt. Hopefully listening or watching This Week in Computer Hardware helped. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.